So when you're in the midst of these tribulations, they're going to see that you're calm. You have hope. Maybe not hope in the next day or the next week or even this life. But we have hope because we have a new life. We have endurance because Christ suffered as we suffered. You go to the scriptures and read it. Yet he was always consistent in prayer, as should we. Now, did he escape death? No. But that was his mission. Okay, what's your mission? I don't know. Yep, that's exactly right. You don't know because God didn't tell you. Because God told you, you'd be bailing. Because that's what we do. You don't take a 2-year-old child and say, here's your future, and oh yeah, you're going to die when you're 43 years old in a car accident and have a good life before then. No, we don't do well in those kinds of situations. But this inner consistency, because we're resting in the Spirit and the Spirit is working through us no matter what, has two fundamental outreaches. One is to the brethren. We contribute to the needs of the saints. Now, saints is just Christians. It just means holy ones. Those who are saved, those who have the new nature, you are now a holy one. Hagios. And the hagiozo is the process by which you are consistently made more holy in the image of Christ. Which is why I use the Greek, because sanctify and sanctification doesn't really tell me much, doesn't gel in my mind about being saints. Too much Catholicism where people get to vote whether you are a good person or not has nothing to do with any of that. But the other arm is seeking to show hospitality. So I got to set table, invite people in, I have to give them lunch. Well, that word hospitality is really philoxenia. Now, philo is love, and we talked about that in Philadelphia. Xenia means strangers. If you are xenophobia, you have a fear of strangers. Now, it's very common. We saw that at the Tower of Babel, when suddenly you had three huge groups of strangers, and they ran away from each other because they were afraid of strangers. They separated themselves out. The Christian, though, is to show love to strangers. This should not be anything new. In Exodus 12:47, very early on in the giving of the ceremonial and civil aspects of the law, God made it very clear several times that there's only one law. One law for the stranger is the same law for the Jew. There's not one law for the Jew and a different law for the strangers. Now, if you read the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Midrash, they totally ignore that. Anybody's not a Jew's an animal. You can't murder an animal, so if a Jew kills you and you're not a Jew, then you're an animal and it's not considered murder. So on and so forth. And yes, these are actually written into those writings. And see, they live by rules, and those rules were always shaped to elevate them. And these qualities differentiate and attract the unsettled lost who are seeking hope. Because They're always noticing that you're different. And those whom God has called are going to be attracted to that difference. 1 Peter 3, verses 13 through 17, Peter says, always be ready to give an explanation. An apologia is an explanation of the hope that is in you, because that is what is attracting them. But if you're whining and complaining and shaking your fist at the government or at the opposition party or grabbing onto your firearms, like it was written in the Bible someplace, you're not attracting the lost. You're acting just like they are. And they expect you to run riot with them like they do. And I want us to understand that Paul's lesson here, his writing, is following Christ's Sermon on the Mount in broad outline. So he segues from showing hospitality to the strangers, because you always hear strangers, you don't know who they are. You don't know what their customs and beliefs are. But to strangers, you are to take them in as you would a countryman and show them hospitality. Give them a bed, give them a meal, so on and so forth. And we see this occurring in the Old Testament several times. But Paul then goes into bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. In other words, don't be human. Don't be sinful. We are a new creation. Thus, because we are different, we should show this difference in our behavior, in our words, in our deeds. And we all struggle with this because the flesh hates to do that. But the mature believer recognizes that we do not fight against flesh and blood. We don't fight against people, but against spiritual powers, Satan and demons, arraying themselves against God. Ephesians 6, 10 through 15. Talks about that, as does Jude, who goes into some detail on that. And Ephesians 6, of course, is the imagery of the armor of God. And of course, within the context of that is a command to stand and stand and stand. We do not curse. We do not fight the lost. We stand. Who are we standing against? Satan. And when we say Satan, you mean the demons too. If you fight the lost, it's returning evil for evil. Now they will one-up you. You go to a fist, they'll go to a club. You go to a club, they'll go to an axe. You go to an axe, they'll go to a rifle. You pick up a rifle, they'll bomb you. They're always going to one-up you. Because, remember, one of the hallmarks of sinners is being out of control. You, being under the tutelage of the Spirit, are being taught to have, are being trained in self-control in the Spirit. Not in the flesh, but in the Spirit. Thus, you're going to realize fairly quickly, hopefully, that this was a battle you didn't want. And it's going to places that you're not prepared to go. And God's not going to bless you. Therefore, there is no battle. There is no war going on. Christ won the war at Calvary. There's just the mopping up action. There's only the gospel, so those who hear can be saved, even as we were saved by the word. We're here not to fight. We're here to stand and hand out the gospel. That armor is defensive. By and large, we are to stand in a defensive stance, protecting each other. I protect the person on my left, the person on my right protects me, so on and so forth. And only the most mature believers are on the far right, where the Spirit is protecting them. Thus, this is what Paul wants us to understand here, is that we are not to get into these kinds of battles, into these kinds of fights, not with relatives, not with friends, not with others, not with neighbors, This is what the lost do all the time. See, we are to do something different with both saved and lost. When others are happy about the common grace received, we calmly, in grace, chairo, rejoice with them. That is what we are supposed to do. That is that same Greek word there again. We are in grace to support them in their joy. Always pointing back to Christ, of course. Because this rejoicing flows from the Spirit. It's grace. And the lost will notice the difference. When people experience the grief that is common to all, we all have loved ones die, we all lose friends, next attack, we all suffer if there's a natural calamity in our area, we all suffer, we help each other. Christians can weep with them. We're not going to band together in rebellion. We're not going to pick up arms and go marching on somebody demanding our rights. But we're to support them in their appropriate grief. Because remember, Christ cares because he suffered grief. Remember Lazarus? And Jesus wept. And his spirit was deeply troubled because he got to experience loss and death like we do. That's why he came lowly and in the flesh, according to Hebrews chapters 1 and 2. So he could suffer like we suffered, thus he could experientially understand and comfort us in our grief. This is being in the world, but not of the world. Remember that prayer that Christ prayed in John 17? Especially in verses 14 through 16. All right. I ask that you keep, that you do not take them out of the world. Because no one else is ever going to get saved. The moment you got saved, your body hits the ground. That's just never going to work for people. So I don't pray you take them out of the world, but I pray you keep them from the world. There's too many Christians today, and supposed Christians that want to be in the world and join hands in the world and march forward arm in arm. It's too bad. However, we must take care not to be overcome by the world. And then verse 18, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. We are to do this phroneo, this harmony, this balance of Christian maturity Because in verse 16, it talks about living in harmony with one another. It's this word phroneo. It literally means a balanced life based on discernment. That's what it's actually meaning. Now, it's a big phraseology there in the English. But all that is contained in the Greek word. So harmony, it's nice, but it doesn't imply in harmony with whom? Well, it's in harmony with God based on discernment of knowing and learning what is evil and rejecting it, abhorring it, hating it, and being glued to the good. So you become inseparable from it. First, to Paul's basis for Christian maturity. Maturing Christians are not to be overcome by the world because he or she experientially learns to reject evil by growth in the Word of God by the Spirit, this discernment. The quintessential example of the church which constantly succumbed to the world was Corinth. And you just go and you read 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, they were just insane. Well, they're like most churches in America. I can't speak for elsewhere, but they're like most churches in America today. Can I do this? Can I? Please, it'll be all right. Can I? No. They want rules so they can break them. But many of today's churches follow Corinth's example, thinking they're doing Jesus a favor. But they're embracing the philosophies of the world and rejecting the gospel of salvation. In other words, they're doing it backwards. They're doing it the way of sinners. They're loving evil and rejecting the good, not being glued to the good, running away from it. So Paul, in staccato fashion now, gives us several examples of a discerning balance in life. This refusal to be seduced by the worldly powerful, by knowing how to be abased as Christ. In other words, we got to be careful that we're not caught up with the powerful in the world. I mean, there was a great, he called himself a Christian philosopher, and he was constantly dropping names. Constantly, or dropping no names. He said, "Well, I can't tell you his name, but he's very powerful, or he's very well known." And he invited me out to his ranch, or he invited me here, or so on and so forth. That is not how it works. We're not to seek that. We are to instead seek out those that the world has rejected, which is the lowly. Now I say that, but I say it advisedly. The lowly lost are no more compassionate toward you than the haughty rich. If they don't want to be saved, they'll be even more brutal and violent. So when you walk among them, you have to not be so starry-eyed that you lose sight of reality. You have to be as wise as serpents, but as harmless as doves when you do this. But otherwise, who's going to take the truth out? One sinful worldview must be rejected as it always seeks to make you the hero of your own story, which means Christ must decrease while you increase. Thus, trials are designed to make us wise. And we're not to repay the evil for evil, as we've already talked about, but we are to repay evil with the good, the kalos, that the Spirit has developed in one's life via the Hayezo process. Remember, we are strangers. Hebrews 11:13-16. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they all recognized they were strangers They were looking for a city to come. And so are we. And in Revelations 21, that city does come. And we get to visit it often. It's a new Jerusalem. As Christ commands each Christian to live at peace with others insofar as it depends on you. Now, you can't go out and make people live at peace with you. You'd like to, but once again, that's returning evil for evil. If you're forcing people to live a certain way, they're going to hate you for it, and rightly so, because you're being the very thing you say you're not. God has let the lost go, that he's not called to salvation. Why can't you? We're not there to beat them into a certain morality. God will watch over us. But insofar as it depends on me, I do try to, sometimes not so good, live at peace with others. Occasionally, my mouth will get the better of me. But this is an area that I pray about, and for a variety of reasons, it's always been a problem. And so prayer is always appreciated. And we have to remember that the world lives by a violent code. That wrong must be avenged. However, this violence only begets violence and destruction. And really, it's the basis of most entertainments. Movies, radio, TV, it's all about violence. It's all about conflict. So conflict, there's no show. The slave was not allowed to take vengeance, though. They'd be wrong. The slave trusted in the master to watch over them. And this is our relationship with the Father. We are slaves to Christ. Romans 6, 15 through 18. Christ trusted the Father, and his soul was secured, though his flesh was sacrificed. That's why he came. And then, though he asked if the cup could pass him by, he recognized he couldn't, and he submitted and went forward, knowing that the Father would raise him up. That just happens to be the same theme that Paul talks about in Romans chapter 4. That was the mindset of Ibrahim when he offered up Isaac at God's command, recognizing that God could raise him again. If God said, do it, Abraham would do it. But he would do it knowing that God was not interested in human sacrifice, but that God would raise Isaac up again because he was going to be the child of promise. And if you got a dead kid, you got no promise. And therefore, nothing else matters after that. So we're to do the same, knowing that we are offerings being consumed so that we stand before Christ's bema seat without shame. Now, we've talked about this many times in the past, especially in Romans. And just in the last few lessons when we talked about the grain offering and the poured out or wine offering, that Paul is discussing how we and our lives are being used as an offering to God, furthering the salvation of others. Now, God will repay the lost for their sin against him. It's not their sin against me or you or us. Lost do not sin against us who are but saved sinners. But it's for their sin against him. Now, Paul quotes from the Old Testament, showing Christianity is not a new faith, but a maturation of the same faith given to Abraham. If you turn to Proverbs 25:21, you read, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. If he is thirsty, give him water to drink, for you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. So, how does Paul phrase that? If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. You have an enemy, and he's in your power, you show him good. Now, Elijah did this, and Elisha certainly did this. God struck the Syrian armies blind. Elisha's slave said, good, now we can all go down and kill him. Elisha says, no, get out of here. That's not how you do this. They're helpless. Give them food and water. Send them on their way. They've suffered enough. See, so the Bible is consistent, cover to cover in this respect. In fact, in all respects, we're to do good to those who are against us. The lost, both passively and actively. This switches accountability from you, for you are imitating Christ, to them who will have no answer justifying their actions. But if the Christian seeks vengeance, then the judgment of God falls on the Christian. And God will deal with you a lot tougher than he'll deal with that lost person. He will just take you to the woodshed and wail away on your butt. Because you're supposed to know better. Now, that's strange terminology today where hardly anyone gets corporal discipline. But see, we will have far less excuse since we have been taught the truth. Therefore, we will be disciplined more severely. And Peter even talks about this. If discipline begins in the church, like, gosh, it's tough. How will it end in the world? Well, Revelations is how it ultimately ends. See, God does not teach us his word for nothing. Each of us will give an account for every unconfessed sin since salvation. And so he ends with this warning. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with the good. If you take up the weapons of the beast, you imitate the beast, becoming the animal that one was before salvation. Remember Job? At the end of the book, God says, okay, get dressed, stand up, act like a man now. Stop groveling in the dirt like a worm. Because he's a sinner. Then he got saved and God told him to stand up and act like a man. Because now he was a human being. It's no surprise that Satan came in the garden as an animal. Because sin had degraded him. And in Revelation, guess what? He's still an animal. He's still that dragon. He's still that beast. And the Antichrist is a beast. And the false prophet is a beast. And sin degrades us back to the position of acting like animals. Now modern philosophy, evolution, embraces that. We're all animals. And they proudly embrace that and parade it around like they're doing something wonderful, and all they're doing is testifying against themselves. Evil can only be overcome by good. If you return evil for evil, they will one-up you. They will have no qualms about nuking you. This is not where you wanted it to go. It shows a stark contrast between God's goodness and evil's absolute corruption. And they think they've won. But none of this is real. This is all transitory. It's what lies behind it that is the true reality. Using violence to bring peace is the illogic of sinners. It's like claiming that war destruction. Brings economic prosperity or growth. It's just insane. That's not how it works. You do not make the economy better by going out and destroying everything. Because that which you are taking to rebuild what was destroyed could have been taken and built new stuff to work in conjunction with what was already there. Thus, the logic that World War II pulled America out of the Great Depression is just insane. America did not end the Great Depression until late 40s, early 50s. We were one of the last nations to do so. Why? Because we idiots. We followed a bad president, a bad philosophy, and reveled in it. Well, same way with sin. So remember, no rules to live by. We're not looking for rules. Rules compel us to fail. Genuine agape is doing, not saying. What did James say in chapter 2? Show me your faith without your works, because that's not going to happen. Because without works, it's an energy. You got nothing. You can say you got stuff, but you have nothing. My faith will shine forth because of what it produces via the power of the Spirit through you and through me. And of course, Paul ends with this warning, do not be overcome by evil, which we constantly want to do. But if you pick up the weapons and philosophy of the lost, you have lost. You have become the beast again. Psalm 73. The man went into the temple of God and recognized how close he had come to slipping back. Because using violence to bring peace is the illogic of sinners. Thus, this whole idea of charging the gates of hell, it's a common euphemism, but it's a misrepresentation of Scripture. It's the first reference to the coming called out assembly in Matthew 16, verses 15 through 18. Christ asks the apostles, who do men say that I am? He gets a variety of answers. Then he looks at them and says, but who do you say that I am? And Peter stood up and said, you are the Messiah. You are the one of God. And then to deflate Peter's ego, Christ said, you didn't think this answer up on your own, just so you know. The Father gave it to you. I know you want to take credit, but you can't. Because anything we learn, we're taught by the Spirit. Anything you learn, you receive from others. Everything. There is nothing original in this world. So whatever we learn about the Scriptures, it comes from the Spirit of God. Should make us feel a little humble. But it's also this play on Greek words that the Catholics missed. And it's very common in Hebraic Scripture to play on words. And remember, they were Hebrew. They were speaking Hebrew or Aramaic. They were used to this word play. Especially Paul, who was trained in the rabbinic methodology. He would have, and does, write in this style, like right here in this latter part of chapter 12. There is some play on words going on. And so, let's turn to Matthew 16 so that we get it right. I know we're going a little over here, but it's important that we grasp this. It says, we'll start in verse 17. Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Petras. And on this Petra, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. So first of all, when Christ talks to him, he calls him by his Hebrew name, not by his Greek name that he was given, but he calls him by his Hebrew name. Then when he calls him by his Greek name that he had given him, because he's going to be going out as an apostle to the Greeks, to the Gentiles, he calls him Petros, which means the stone. Small stone. But when Christ says, and on this Petra, he's referring to himself. A Petra is a large rock, very large. And of course, this is direct reference right back to Daniel chapter 2, verses 31 through 45, in the image of Nebuchadnezzar, when a rock that was cut out without hands falls on the foot of the beast, this huge statue of the four kingdoms and the revived Roman kingdom, and destroys it and develops a kingdom that lasts for eternity. That is what Christ is referring to when he says, on this rock, I will build my ecclesia, and the gates of hell should not prevail against it. Why? Because I'm going to destroy those gates of hell myself by dying and being resurrected. So, when I said the war was won, it's done. It's finished. It's over. God does not need you to charge the gates of hell. First of all, the spiritual, and you can't find them. So, I don't know what you think you're doing, waving your sword or rifle around, being militant, because that is not the example that Christ gave us. It is to be humble. We are to stand. We are to stand. We are to stand. We are to withstand. In Ephesians 6, 10 through 13, repeats that three times at least. Militant Christianity is weak faith, seeking works to please God, using ways of the world which destroys one's maturation, being overcome by evil. Do you have God's wisdom? Your behavior reveals whether you possess the wisdom of God or the foolishness of sin, which masquerades as wisdom but strengthens the flesh. You know, in James, in chapter 3, verses 13 through 18, and we're not going to go there and read them, but I encourage you to do so. You just get this sense that James, and his name actually is Yaqub or Jacob, has lived this. Mature faith is meek, resting in Christ, producing godly peace. Think the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5. Immature faith is largely sin. It's not sinful because it's immature. You're immature because you're still following a lot of sinful habits from your worldview and your flesh. And you're trying to make rules so you can control it. And it's a growing phase. And we all get... We all go through it, and we get through it, hopefully. But immature faith is largely tainted with jealousy and selfish ambition, which spring from covetousness. And they just produce inner turmoil. You don't have peace. God knows the world is fooled. One seeks dominance rather than obtaining a harvest that can be given to Christ. And this was the error of Judaism. That's why they failed. As a group, individuals were saved out of it, by all means. And Paul wrote these words having suffered for the faith. He knew exactly what he was writing about. You want to take a look at Paul's back? You see pictures of 19th century American slaves with their back all scarred up from the whip? It'd probably be nothing compared to Paul's back. Finally, we are to judge ourselves so that we may not be judged. This is the ultimate mark of maturity, as Christ explained in the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. Believers held accountable, since we belong to Him and act in His name. We are held accountable. When one works with the Spirit, one exhibits these marks of maturity that we've talked about as a spring from one's new nature. When one quenches the Spirit, one's sinful mindset rises, but it is not satisfied, as the new nature desires the will of Christ. The Spirit disciplines you if you are saved. So if you're acting like the world and you're not being spanked, if you're not saved. Now, I can't look at you and make that determination. You should be able to, but remember, there's that group that believed they were saved and weren't. It's very easy to fool ourselves into one thing when something else is absolutely true. And it's very sad to realize that at the wrong time. And living in sin promotes the flesh, which is at war with the Spirit. Thus one loses inner peace until one confesses one's sin and returns to Christ. Do you have peace? I know Christians who take as much antidepressants and antipsychotics as the world does. We shouldn't be taking one of them, because we have Christ. I believe that that shows that we, or those who do this, are not at peace. They're not happy with Christ. He's not moving in their direction. They're frustrated in the world. They want the world to act like they want it to act, which would make them the hero of their own story. And they would be then replacing Christ. So this is the trap there one falls into. Now our next lesson will be about government and removing the layers of myth that comes from a simplistic, hyper-literal approach to the first few verses in Romans chapter 13. Hope you join us then. Thank you.